Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Tammy with us. Welcome back, Tammy. And
thank you.
And I got to say this, that the debt is fraud. And please, folks, let's start invoking the power of prayer. I mean, I hope everybody's praying for you know, the outcome that will help us save this republic through this upcoming election. Now, previously, I kind of talked about, and I think tomorrow, we'll know tomorrow what the outcome is because today is election day. But previously, I've talked about the significance of the election and how our choices are not really our choices. We're granted, you know, which path, you know, when we look at Ronald Reagan, when we look at the choices that we've been given through the party system, through the controls, the party controls of American politics, it's not, we have not had the best rise to the top in America. And the only way we can do that is actually, we have to take it back and take, you know, break free from the party control or the party form of government, the corporate form of government, and so forth and so on. So anyway, I want to kind of dive into the content, and I know that everybody else is probably waiting because this next part of the 14th Amendment is where everybody really misinterprets all of this. Now, as we've already covered in the 14th Amendment, we've already covered the section that covered the apportionment, right? That was the last thing we did. And we covered before that section 3, which is how we have now the teeth. Now, folks, it's not something that we go to court. Let me back up. When you look at Section 3, it doesn't say that there's any due process in this process at all, right? Do you remember any due? Does this go to court? No, it doesn't go to court. You know, no person shall be. In other words, this is like a qualification. It's like a standard. It is like the eligibility for you to be able to serve and to continue to serve. In other words, for you to have the authority to, you know, to work, it's kind of like the deal with Samson and his strength. You cut your hair, you lose your strength, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you cut your hair, you lose your strength. And in this particular case, if you violate your oath, if you fail to support the Constitution, you can't be a public servant. There's nowhere here where there's a guarantee of due process. You do not get to defend yourself. You're not being sent to jail. The whole point of due process is when your liberties are going to be taken from you, your life and or your property. Your ability to serve the people is a grant. It is, you know, an opportunity. It is not property. It is not your liberty. It is not your life. This is, you know, an opportunity. And therefore, Section 3 is very clear that you don't even get to defend yourself. And when I created the pledge, which you signed, and I appreciate the extent you went to try to meet that. But when you look at the pledge actually provides you with the ability to refute a false accusation, because we want to make sure until we get to a point where people really understand how to create not an accusation, but a constitutional argument of how somebody had violated their oath. Now, we may find ourselves in a situation, and, you know, I can't imagine it, but I'm sure that it'll happen, where a public servant is, you know, the old expression, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And so that's where it comes down into the petitioner, you know, to say, well, it's damned if, damned because you did, not because you didn't. And however that goes, those are the fine lines that public servants have to walk. But if you violate your oath and you find no other way to do it, and I can't imagine how violating your oath of office, if, you know, in one way and not, you know, and in the other way, you'd be violating your oath. In other words, you know, you can't straddle that line that, you know, this action, you violate that action. What do you do? I don't think that's going to come up at all. I don't think that when we look at the way servants are supposed to behave, I don't think that it's going to be, you know, that kind of ambiguous. I think it's really going to be cut and dry. You cross that line. And so when people get really good at clarifying, you cross that line. One of the things that I would recommend, because I'm not king, but the constitutions are king. When John Adams laid it out in a Republican form of government, when they were just trying to figure out, this was during Continental Congress before the Declaration of Independence, you know, what kind of government were they going to form? And, you know, as they were forming this Continental Congress, John Adams wrote this article regarding a republic. You know, it must be a republic. I forget the name of the article, but, and it's in Why Counties Matter Most. But what he basically said is, in a republic, the law is king. And that's one of the reasons why Britain kind of formed with the Magna Carta. They formed a monarchical republic, which is why the counties had their representation, were the land barons of those counties. And, you know, how they migrated from, you know, these land barons to counts to, you know, these sub, I'll call them sub life forms of royalty. Because back, you know, at the Magna Carta, there weren't dukes and duchesses and all of that. The reason that those families were elevated, it was because of their loyalty and service to the crown. And so they were, you know, granted because of that, because of their due diligence or because of their great behavior, whatever their contribution was, they were elevated to become a baron. I don't know if they had barons in England, but they had counts and they had princes and so forth. And I think a prince is in the direct line, you know, and if you want to really study the monarchical, you know, heritage, you can. But bottom line, Britain became a republic because these land barons who actually controlled different parts of the land actually was granted this autonomy as well as they were granted these rights. And so when we look at America, we don't have a king that has all the sovereignty. We don't even have a president, or even Congress doesn't have the full sovereignty. Congress has limited powers of how they can make law. They can only make law based on the powers granted in this Constitution. If it's not direct, the law that they create is not directly derived from a power granted, then they can't create the law. And I'll give you a good example of a power granted. A power granted is that they have the power to make an uniform rules of naturalization and bankruptcies. In other words, they have the power to create a law, to create a uniform process for people to become citizens of the United States, as well as to declare bankruptcy throughout the United States. Do they have the power, because it's in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 2, do they have the power to play with how the people are to be represented? No, that is not a power. The powers are listed right there in Article 1, Section 8. What is listed in Article 1, Section 2 is the standard of how they are to represent we the people, that only 30,000 people are going to be able to, they don't have to compete beyond 30,000 to one representative. That's the best way to put it. Because if you all of a sudden have 35,000 people, then you have to break that representation up between two representatives. And the charge on the state is, as they grow in representation, they kind of want to balance it all out so that they all have very similar or equal representation. So it may be 25,000 amongst all of them, or, 28 and a half, or however. They try to divide it up as close as possible. But the Constitution's clear that
they do it per person or per voting.
So in the very beginning, it was however they wanted to define it, because going back, if you read, and this is worth going back to, if you read Article 1, Section 2, and this is the apportionment, it basically goes in to say, the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 30,000. Does that mean persons?
For every person.
Does that mean persons? No, it doesn't say persons.
Oh, that's true.
It says, but each state shall have at least one representative, and until such enumeration, in other words, until they actually have a census, then they will actually be able to enumerate accurately how, what each state gets. And every 10 years, they make an adjustment. And so,
if it were every 30,000, we should have 16 or so.
Yes, right. Wyoming should have that many. And technically, here's where Wyoming's representation would go up dramatically, just because of its state and its condition. Remember that illegals, invaders, do not get representation. It has to be at least a citizen. It has to be at least a person. And so do they count children or not?
Yeah.
So here's the question. Does a child get representation? Now, let's look at it this way. Because this is what they were doing. They were trying to figure out how to create the best advantage, for themselves as a state. And I think that, if you look in the North, where factories were starting to become more prominent, family size was going down because you didn't have to have a lot of hands working the family business. If you were agrarian, if your family made its money by farming and agrarian, then the families were much larger. So the question is, if you counted children, then you would actually have better representation as adults, right? Because now you have, let's just say 1,000, let's say 5,000, and each family has, 10 kids. Well, that's 50,000 people. And then you go up to, let's say, Massachusetts, and they only have 2 kids per family. And they were counting 50,000, well, then they would literally have, if you did the math, you'd realize there would be more people, more adults in Massachusetts that would be competing for their representation than in the South. Does that make sense? Because mm-hmm. Does a child have a right to petition their representative? No.
Not, so the representatives are their parents.
Also, you got to remember, and we're going to get into this with the 14th Amendment, but your rights of petitioning, your right of freedom of expression, your right of, all of these things are really handed to U.S. citizens. So you really have to transition to the age of being a citizen. You're born with the birthright of becoming a citizen, but can you vote?
Yeah.
No, you can't vote until you turn 18 based on the 26th Amendment, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so does a child, 12 years old, do they have a right to go to D.C.? Because today the court will tell you, yeah, they have a right. As a matter of fact, these 6-year-olds have a right to demand what kind of curriculum they're going to have. This is how crazy we've been. We've gone down this path of allowing the children to raise themselves.
And allowing the children to raise their parents.
Right. And when we look at, excuse me, when we look at a well-disciplined and a well-established society, you protect your children. The parents have the responsibility for the children, and they are not to be, you know, immersed, or they're not to be exposed to the world until they've reached a certain age. And so we had a good system going, but they knew that if they empowered the children would not have the maturity or wisdom to make the best decision for themselves, which is why they want children at the youngest age possible to start determining, you know, what's best for them, their orientations, what they're going to do, and so forth. And I'm going, hold on here. That is overstepping the state's bounds. And every state in the union has laws that recognize the parents' role in the household, that they're the ones that are responsible for those children. And so we've created a society that kind of gives the best of all worlds, or society or government is trying to butter its bread on every side of the slice. In other words, they want to hold you accountable when it serves them, and then they want to hold, you know, give the kids the ability to make those decisions when it serves them. And so as long as they're getting the outcomes, then they're going to say, yeah, we want this side of the bread buttered as well. And it's all being done deliberately to undermine us. So anyway, now we get to dive, and when I say dive, we really get to dive into the 14th Amendment to Section 1, because this is where we find four parts. There's four kind of clauses or segments to this that kind of lay out where everybody finds this problem. Now, the first part is the first sentence, and it starts off with the yellow lettering and it ends with the red lettering. So just read that first sentence. Go ahead.
All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside.
Okay, now let me stop right there. Does this say anything that a person becomes a subject to the United States?
No.
No.
No, absolutely not.
Okay, so this is where there's the state, national, sovereign citizens, all these different groups that say this makes us a subject. This makes us that they own us. Do you see anything there that says that they are now taking ownership of people?
No.
That language isn't there. And so these people that make this assertion are saying, well, it's, you know, it was understood at that time. And I've gone through the debates, and I challenge anybody. We do not have the time to go through the debates. And they're on my website on the Constitutional Articles page. And I think they may even be on the podcast page. I put them up twice. So that, you know, it'd be easier for you to find. But go read, download this. It's about 60 megs, and it's 263 pages. It's a PDF file, but you can go through this. And technically, when you look at one page, there are three columns, and these are big pages. Technically, one column is equivalent to a page in Word. So when you say 263 pages times three, it's almost it's almost 900 pages of, you know, dialogue. And so I've transitioned this into a Word document, and but it's really doesn't transition very well. But bottom line, and I think it's about 1,000 pages. The bottom line, if you scrub through this document, and that's how I scrub through it, because when you read it, it's hard to keep context to everything. But I've gone through and looked for subject and jurisdiction in searches in the Word document. And there is nowhere at all where there is any indication or application that this line would subjugate the people of the United States. As a matter of fact, this line did not exist in the original draft of the 14th Amendment. Actually, the only line that existed, as I understand it, in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was actually this last part, which were these next three clauses. And actually, I don't think that the whole due process and all of this with the equal protection of the laws, I don't think that it was that robust. And what ended up happening was this last part that we're going to read, which actually has three different parts to it, was not nearly robust. The real genesis behind Section 1 was what we're going to read next. But the reality is, and I'm going to break this down, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. So if you're born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, how is a slave subject to the jurisdiction thereof? In the Constitution, and we go into Article 1, were they not considered at that point in time, because they were slaves, they were considered a grant of representation in the federal government by three-fifths. In other words, maybe not the whole person, but each person had at least a portion of representation in the House of Representatives, right? Because that was the three-fifths rule. So in other words, they may not have had a full representation, but they did have a right to representation. How's that not under the jurisdiction? When they created the Constitution, they granted jurisdiction to not only the people, but their slaves as well. Now, the big argument in the Constitutional Convention was, are they people or are they property? And that's why the South wanted to have their bread buttered on both sides. They wanted to keep them as property, but they wanted to claim them as people. And the North said, no, you can't do that. We're not going to let you do that. You claim them as property, they get no representation. Well, they're partly property, they're partly. And so are they more property or are they more persons? Okay, they're a little more persons. So that's why they came up with the three-fifth rule.
They're three-fifths of a person.
Right. And this was a compromise because, and as a matter of fact, when you read the Constitution, folks, if you want to understand that this was really not as racist as it was really about representation, and it was about politics and power. The South wanted to have the benefit because when you have a plantation, you may have a large family, but you have a lot of hands that, you know, actually do that work. And they knew if they didn't get representation for all of the hands that were working their plantation, they would not have the same amount of representation in the House of Representatives in contrast to Massachusetts and these other states. So it was granting them political power by basically saying, we want our slaves to have apportionment. And that's why they said, hold on here. And that's why the North kind of held them to, you can't do that. You can't claim. And it became this big, huge debate, philosophical debate. But bottom line.
Yeah, so they wanted political power and they wanted to keep their slaves.
Yes, we got less than 20 seconds. But bottom line, they were subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, we're going to talk about Indians. Are Indians subject to the jurisdiction of the United States during, you know, at this point in time in 1866 when this was being drafted? And so think about this as we go into break, because just remember, almost all of the Indians, there were some Indians that weren't taxed, but all the Indians themselves, period, all of them, were either living in territories or they were living within states that had reservations that were controlled by who? The federal government. The territories were fully controlled by the federal government until they became a state. And these unconstitutional little bastions called reservations were also controlled. And they were violations of the Constitution, but nonetheless, we will be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we look at the different stages or conditions for the Native Americans or the Indians, as the Constitution refers to them, when we look at the different stages of their relationship in North America, many of them had been basically contained, captured, what have you, and forced onto federal lands. Technically, when the federal government created a state, now, did you see anywhere in the enumerations of property, remember going back to Article 1, Section 8, they have the power to erect forts, magazines, arsenals, shipyards, and needful buildings. Those five things.
Mm-hmm.
Does any of those include, you know, an area of land to place people on so that they can control them?
No.
Okay. All right. So the federal government doesn't have the authority. They never had the authority to do that, to basically create a parcel of land within a state, nevertheless. Now, they may have been able to create or edge out in, because remember, in Article 1 or Article 4, Section 3, they have the ability in the territories, and I'm going to go back up to this because it's important that we read these things. Because in Article 4, Section 3, new states may be admitted by the Congress. So, in other words, the only way a new state could be admitted into the government, into the union, was by Congress. Now, the next clause is not a granting of power. This is what they're expected to be able to do to make that happen. The Congress shall have, it says, the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. It ends when it becomes a state. When that state is transitioned away from the federal government and becomes its own sovereign entity, the federal government cannot possess any land. And we went through this spent a lot of time on that. Because even the forts that existed in that state, technically, based on the Constitution, the federal government has to turn right back around and buy that property from the state. And instead, we found that the federal government started taking latitude in 1819 and on to say, you know what, this is our property. When you transition, we're going to keep it our property. No. The Constitution says you can't have any property within that state unless you've purchased it and it's been authorized for only these things, not for, you know, energy purposes or, you know, spotted owls or people or trees or anything. Only for these purposes, you can purchase this land at the consent of the state legislature. That's it. So the atrocity was this concept and the way the federal government created this process of actually aggrandizing their role, because next thing you know, they had the Indians Bureau and the management. All of those laws were all being done unconstitutionally. And so here's the question, because I know people think about this. Well, don't the Indians have a right to sue and you know, to get compensation or No, they don't, actually. It's the same thing with the states. And it's kind of like when we were going through the Civil War, it wasn't about reparations. It was about freedom. And Frederick Douglass said, leave them alone. As a matter of fact, he harped when they started going through, not the reparations, but the Reconstruction. He says, leave these people alone. Because all you're doing is you're keeping them in one place, because if you stay here, we're going to give you money and take care of you. You leave, we can't take care of you. And he goes, that was a huge disservice of the federal government using power that they didn't have, even though it was the people thought it was a noble thing. Oh, we're helping these people out. Let them go. Let the people go so they can actually start making their own decisions. Because really, going back to that scale of liberty, people have to make their own decisions. They have to decide, are they going to become, because the slaves were basically being kept in areas so that they would be able to, you know, do the work that, you know, they were granting them the ability to do agrarian work. And actually, many of the slaves just walked away from Reconstruction. I should say many of the freemen walked away from Reconstruction, and they actually started showing up in the northern states and into the factories and so forth. And Thomas Sowell accounts for this migration of people leaving the South, going north. And as a matter of fact, he starts talking about how the North had started changing their attitude towards the South. But the interesting thing was that it wasn't the changing their attitude about the freemen from the South. It was the whites from the South trying to leave because they were no longer slaves or indentured or what have you, serfs of the land. And they were actually going up there, but they were lazy. And they were moving into houses like, you know, I hate to use the term, so I won't use an insect, but kind of like an infestation, because they were bringing blight into the communities because they weren't willing to work. And Thomas Sowell really highlights this. As a matter of fact, he also points out, and folks, if you've never read Black Rednecks and White Liberals by Thomas Sowell, you need to, because he says that all you had to do, and because it was documented, when you floated down the Ohio River, on the south side, you would see cows in wooded areas, and, you know, there would be gangly and, you know, not well fed and not well taken care of. And on the other side of the river, the fields would be cleared, there'd be grass, and the cows were looking healthy and good. And even though there were less cows in the north than there were in the south, more butter was being created in the north than it was in the south, because the cows weren't being treated well, because the people were too poor or they were just too lazy. As a matter of fact, the whole Trail of Tears was actually proven that it was the Cherokee in the south that was outworking, because they had motivation. They were becoming successful. They actually created the first newspaper in that area. They were getting organized and getting industrious in providing services and products and so forth. And the lazy Southerners said, hey, you know, when we want to work, we want to do those things, and we can't do those things anymore because they're doing it. And they complained, and they got Andrew Jackson to violate the Constitution and round them up and put them on the Trail of Tears and killing them. Not all of them, but it was a significant death and a significant tragedy in American history of an exertion of unconstitutional power. Government has to be held accountable. It's not that we can sue, because technically there's no mechanism of the government having to pay out for, you know, for these damages of what they perceived as something they had the power to do. Even though they didn't have the power to do it, the responsibility, as Madison constantly pointed out, the states had to keep them in check. And as they felt that the states were doing their, as the federal government was doing the state's bidding, then, okay, well then, you know, it's, we'll allow it. We'll allow these things. It didn't make it legitimate, because the only way to legitimize it would have been by going through an amendment and actually granting them the power to do those things. Thomas Jefferson tried to actually do that in 1803, long before this happened, by giving them the power to actually grant land and create, you know, sovereign states for the Native Americans, for the Indians. And so we have a lot of people that made bad decisions for whatever reason. It doesn't matter. What matters is those of us who are alive today have to put off the shackles and actually start dusting off our boots, dusting off our clothes, and start, you know, living in the world we have today. And so, and we have to be thankful that we have this opportunity to have the liberty to do whatever we want moving forward once we reclaim our liberty. But this, oh, I want to make $5 million or whatever it was because my lap got scalded from hot coffee. Those types of concepts of punitive value are all under civil law. Those are not common law. Common law is about seeking justice, not compensation. Not trying to make money for both the lawyer. That's one of the reasons why in common law, we don't have as many lawyers. As a matter of fact, the people that have a right to bring cases in court were, in the old days, just the men of the house. They were the patriarchs. They were technically both the farmer, the lawyer, the businessman. I mean, you know, they were working the taxes, all of that. And common law is basically a law that extends the privileges to every citizen to be able to challenge, you know, and seek justice. But it's about, common law is about justice, not about compensations. And so we have lots of people that constantly focus on, we need compensation. Now, it's one thing to recover something that was stolen from you. If, let's just say, you got the Mona Lisa, and you acquired that Mona Lisa from your family, and, you know, way down, six generations down, your grandma was, you know, walking through, you know, a little fair or what have you, and she noticed this picture, and she said, hey, that's a nice picture. I like that. And she paid the person, because they didn't know, you know, what it really was, that they, you know, she paid them $5, whatever. And she takes it home and she realizes that the canvas on it is kind of buckling. And she goes, huh. And as she starts examining it more, she realizes that the canvas is actually a layered canvas on top of it. And so she peels that off and lo and behold, the Mona Lisa is underneath that. And now she knows she has a rare find. And she knows also that she didn't buy the Mona Lisa, that this has probably been stolen, and so she kind of keeps it in, you know, in a room where she can share it with very, you know, few people, and they keep it a secret. And so for six generations, this family kept it as a secret. Well, by the time this new person, you know, was now given them this property of this painting, mom's favorite painting, great-great-great-grandma's favorite painting. That's what they called it. They didn't call it the Mona Lisa. And then all of a sudden they go, you know what, I think this is the Mona Lisa. I'm going to go sell it. And they go out and they say, here, I have the Mona Lisa and I want to sell it. All of a sudden, everybody knows now who the original property holder, let's just say it was the, let's say the Youngs. You know, the Youngs were the ones that actually, a very specific family in the Young family back in France owned that thing. And they, you know, they reported it stolen and they never got it back. Even if you don't have a deed, but you can actually prove, any way you can prove that that property is yours, guess what? That property is given back to you when it is proven that it's yours. you that's your property, mm-hmm. and if it was taken from you, whether it was generations ago or just now, if somebody unlawfully took your property, then and it's your property, it is yours. This is one of the reasons why you hear me rail. And I, one of these days, folks, I'm going to capture on Sean Hannity or one of these other, you know, conservative radio shows that are out there trying to sell you property insurance, title insurance. How is it in a world today that you actually have property, that you could be stripped away from your property because somebody fraudulently took money out on it? How is it you can lose that property? How is it that there's not yeah. states that are creating laws that say no person can lose their property because of fraud? And if you don't have the pure, hardcore evidence that that is the person that took those loans out, and you can't prove that this is the person that took advantage and tried to, you know, scam, you know, all of this, you know, this whole thing, this whole situation, then you can't take that property. It's theirs. You're out. Bank, you're out, company, insurance, or whoever. How is it that we have lawmakers that allow these situations? And I'm telling you how. Because the company that came out with title insurance is making money off that. And they would rather force you to actually pay to cover something than, in other words, than instead of you just standing up and saying, how can you even take this? This is my property. I shouldn't even mm-hmm. have to relinquish, you know, for a second, this property. The bank, before they can come in and even do a foreclosure, has to go through this enormous body of work. And actually, here's the other problem, that the data is out there because the government puts it out there. So when we really want to start, you know, slapping hands and holding people accountable for making this market exist, this fraud exists in America. Well, as far as I see it, then we need to actually go after those county governments that are putting the titles out there. Whoever is doing this, you know, and making it so accessible so somebody can actually look at that deed. As a matter of fact, the deed in its official form should actually not provide the signature so somebody can't forge it. We got to do something because I'm telling you, it is unconscionable that people are losing their property because of fraud. When you know, and actually yeah. those people, we need to start hanging them. I mean, we used to hang people for stealing your horse. Shoot, stealing your home? We ought to draw and quarter them or keel haul them. I mean, it's the punishment should be very egregious because when we really look at the average American, the greatest investment they have is their property. And it may not be much, but that's it. And the fact that mm-hmm. they've made it so easy, but anyway, I digress. The point is that the federal government, in Article 1, or not Article 1, back to the 14th Amendment. When we look at the 14th Amendment, and they talk about the jurisdiction of the citizens, whether they be Indians or whether they be blacks, freemen, or whomever. If you are residing here under the jurisdiction, you then become a U.S. citizen at that point. You're entitled to be a U.S. citizen. Now, this did not change necessarily the standard of migration. This only did a abracadabra. Everybody that has been living here under our jurisdiction for years and years and has been kept out of representation and kept out of our system because of, you know, what we have done in our laws, we undo it now with this magical wand. You are now a citizen. It doesn't mean that if you're a black person or a Indian or some indigenous person from another nation and you come here and you get born here or the parents come here and they are born in the United States. They are not there. I'm sorry. Parents come here and they have a child that's born in the United States. This does not make that child a citizen because the children are always based on a uniform rule of naturalization. The children are always the citizenship of the parents. The fact that you gave birth to a child on American soil does not make that child a citizen. The only way that child can become a citizen is by actually having been born by citizens. And that's why when we look at a natural born citizen, it lays out this clarity that you have to be born by citizens. And under the laws of nation, and we have a great petition on the natural born citizen, folks, and we need to start cycling this around because we need everybody, because it was too late to get all of this out because we knew that, you know, we're not a nationwide brand. Reclaiming the Republic is not, everybody's not talking about us in these petitions. But if you take this petition, you get your Republican Party to start passing it around. We're going to be changing it in the next week or so. Maybe, and it'll probably take me a month because I've got too many things to do. But we're going to get this changed so that you can start, you know, getting it around to challenge the fact if Kamala Harris actually becomes a citizen, she needs to be removed. Any person that is in the executive office, and it's not going to be a Kamala Harris petition anymore. It will be a petition demanding the compliance of the natural born citizen, the natural born citizen requirement, because no more are we going to allow anybody to even play in the campaign stage like Vivek Ramaswamy or Nikki Haley. No more playing on the campaign stage. If you're not eligible to become a, you know, the president because you're not a natural born citizen, you don't even get a chance to be on the ballot or even in the campaign, period. I mean, it's almost like, why would the state legislature actually bring a law to be voted on the floor of the state legislature that would violate the Constitution like a digital currency? Why? How could that even happen? How could they actually vote and pass a law that violates the Constitution? Because they've compromised, they're going to allow it to be so. But clearly the Constitution, Section 3, does not allow them to do that. Okay.
Yeah.
So I've harped and harangued a bit. Let's go through this next, because this next clause, and it goes to the semicolon. So it goes, no state shall, and then it goes all the way down through citizens of the United States, semicolon. You see that? So let's read this next two lines that's a part of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment.
No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States.
Okay, so what that means is no state shall make or enforce any law. Now, let me ask you this. Does a state have the authority to allow businesses to be created? Yes. The federal government does not have anywhere, nowhere in the Constitution, do they have the authority to deny or allow businesses to be formed. That is strictly a state responsibility, and that was one of the very first things that states actually took and regulated. They did regulate businesses. And so the question is, in your Constitution, did you grant them that power? If not, they need that power. And so we want to make sure that they have some body of being able to regulate. Why is that so important? Well, whether or not they have the power to regulate or not, right here it says that they cannot make or enforce, and the or enforce is the critical part. Because if there is a business that is registered with the state, like Amazon or like Google or any business, Walmart, that is coming along and they're saying, you have to blank. You have to get shots. You have to be immunized. You have to do these things. Then if that person is not, and they lose their job because that state has, or I should say that company, has denied you your privileges and immunities. Because, see, the state's responsibility is to make sure your privileges and immunities are being protected. Mm-hmm. And they cannot allow a company to actually enforce a rule or policy that denies you your privileges and immunities. If you have a right of conscientious objection, and I'll give you a good case in point. If a corporation came along and created an insurance, and let's just say the insurance is all of a sudden going to cover, you know, elective surgery, and you feel that elective surgery is, you know, violates your conscience, that you will not allow, however they, because what they do is, this is how insurance companies work. They create this number of how much they have to charge for your contribution and your employer's contribution to cover all of these costs. And so if you come along and say, hey, you have to give me the ability to opt out because I have a conscientious objection against that service, that you're taking my money to be used in that way. Let's say abortion, an elective surgery, elective procedure. And so I refuse to allow you to take that money or to charge me and to use my money to do that. So you have
to. What about a company requiring somebody to wear a mask?
Same. Because bottom line, you know,
that's always what I've thought. Same thing. They can't do that. They're like, oh, it's my business. I can ask you to do what I want.
Absolutely. But they can only do those things. They can only ask you to do those things that do not violate your privileges and immunities. Technically, you have a right to carry arms. And as a matter of fact, technically, if you're a part of the militia, and see, this is why, because we abandoned the militia, we're in this really bad spot. We have mercenary forces. When a sheriff or a law enforcement officer goes onto the premises of a facility where they say the employees can't have arms, do they tell, oh, sheriff, you can't have that? No, because they're working in the function of their job. Well, when we look at the militia, that's our function. That's our, you know, so this is why taking back our responsibilities, the militia, then all of a sudden we don't have a mercenary force. And the fact that they would take away the arm, or I should say the sidearm, the gun that is supposed to be with that militia person because they're on call.
Yeah.
Right. Because that's the way we're supposed, we're not supposed to be spending money at, you know, whatever the tune it is for security. We are the security of this nation. And I know it's nice to be able to pay professionals to do things like that. But when you do that, you surrender sovereignty. Everything you surrender to somebody else, you're surrendering your sovereignty and giving it to them. This is why this, all of this stuff is just so, so important. So we're not going to finish this, but bottom line, if you all of a sudden says, I'm not, you know, there's, you're going to, you know, actually rip the, you force a mask on your face or something like that, and they actually call the police in to say, you have to get this person to do something and, or, you know, take this person out. You're now, they're asking the state to enforce a law that abridges your privileges and immunities. So we'll expand on this particular part or this clause of Section 1 because you need to understand it. And we'll actually put more context to this. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flow chart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.